Welcome to Film Roast.
Hey everyone, Hannah here, the co-host of Film Roast, where two overcaffeinated and underqualified friends talk about all things movies. If you like film factoids, lots of sarcasm, and bad impressions, check us out on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Film Roast Show and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/filmroast. Happy roasting!
Hello, everybody.
Hi, friends.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm going to be talking to you about Sophie Scholl.
Ooh, nice. I'm going to be sharing the story of Cut Niek Dien.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm. Tell me about her.
All right. So she was born in Aceh, Besar, in Indonesia.
Okay.
In 1848. Her family was an Islamic aristocratic family, and her father was a member of the ruling class, and her mother also came from the aristocracy, so she had a pretty good upbringing and background. She was educated in religion and household matters, and after several marriage proposals, her parents arranged her marriage to Tekuk Ibrahim Lamga when she was 12 years old.
Oof.
Now, here's the thing. There's like a lot of historical background to get into about the era that she grew up in before we can kind of delve into her story. So hold on tight. For starters, Aceh, it's a semi-autonomous Indonesian province, and it's located on the northwest tip of Sumatra Island.
Okay.
And it was guaranteed independence by the Anglo-Dutch Treaty of 1824, and it also held statutes as a protectorate of the Ottoman Empire since the 16th century. So it was kind of this protected little island area from colonial rule and influence. And it became, of course, a political and commercial success and flourished because it didn't have all these colonial people trying to come in and mess everything
right
up. So the area was separated into different territories that were controlled by rajas and sultanates as the head of each territory. And in the 1830s, there was one leader who kind of brought all of the territories under his control and started expanding this protected territory further down east, the coast of Indonesia. So this sort of independent area is trying to grant more independence as they go down, which does not sit well with the Dutch's northward expansion on the east coast. So they're kind of both coming at each other.
Creeping towards each other.
Exactly. Now, in 1869, the Suez Canal opened, and it allowed for a change of shipping routes. So the British and the Dutch signed a new treaty in 1871, which was the Anglo-Dutch Treaty of Sumatra, which ended any British territorial claims to Sumatra and basically made the Dutch the only foreign influence in the area.
Okay.
So Dutch are the only people that have control.
I see trouble brewing.
Right. So in the exchange, Britain gained control of the Dutch Gold Coast in Africa. With much more control in the Sumatra area, the Dutch, of course, turned their attention now. Like, we don't have anyone else that's getting in our way. Let's go after the Aceh area. So they could eliminate that threat because it posed, you know, oh, it's going to be an independent nation. We have to ward off this and other rival colonial powers.
Right.
How dare we let them rule themselves? No. Obviously, the leaders of the Aceh did not respond positively to this, and they took a meeting with some American leaders, interestingly, which the Dutch considered a violation of the treaty. So the Dutch declared war on, not on America, on
the Aceh.
So
these people who were not signatories of this treaty,
exactly,
they violated it.
Right, exactly. So the first Aceh war, which the Achenese actually won, the Dutch severely underestimated their forces, and their head commander was shot dead almost immediately.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So off the war lasted from 1873 to 1904 and nearly bankrupted the Dutch colonial government.
Oh, my God.
Now, this is the time, all of this war is kind of the background, is the time that Cut Niek Dien is growing up and she got married. In 1873, during Dutch's second Aceh War, the Dutch successfully captured the district where she lived, and Cut Niek Dien and her baby were evacuated from the area. Now, her husband Ibrahim stayed and fought to reclaim the area. 5 years into the war, into the fight, her husband was killed in action on June 29th, 1878. Now, if you remember any of our other ladies, let's see if we can guess where this is going. She swears revenge against the Dutch and joins the army.
Oh my God.
Of course. I mean, she already strongly disliked the Dutch. I mean, obviously. But one main reason that she was vehemently against them was because they had destroyed the Grand Mosque, and that was seen as a huge affront to religious beliefs of her people. So after her husband died, the head of the Etchanese army, someone who was considered a hero, proposes marriage to her. And at first she rejects him, but then she accepts his proposal only when he agrees that she can continue fighting in the war.
I have conditions.
Right. I'm not stopping just because I'm married to the head commander. Right.
I'm not doing those household things I'm educated in.
Exactly. So they were married in 1880. Now, this was a marriage between her, a high-ranking member of the aristocracy, and Tuku Umar, who was just the leader of the army. And it actually boosted the morale of their people. And the two of them went to join in the fight. So it was kind of like a Cinderella story. But the prince was Cinderella? Not the prince, the leader of the army.
The guy was the one being raised by the status of the other.
Right.
Amazing.
So there is a story out there also that she had raised a large army of her own that she led, and the two of them combined forces after they were married.
Okay.
So it was after fighting together that he proposed to her. Which is kind of cute.
Yeah, like
and
battle
fun.
Buddies.
Mm-hmm. And she got pregnant, had a daughter named Kut Gambang, but Dian didn't want to leave the war, so she just took her daughter with her. Like casual.
Like in a papoose?
I guess. Just like as you do. Right. Oh, come on, honey.
Did she have a little tiny sword? I hope she had a little tiny sword.
Please. Please. And rides on like a baby elephant.
Yes.
Please.
Oh, my word.
Please. Or baby horse, whatever they're riding.
Talk about a children's show.
Oh, all the things. War continued on into the 1890s, and the Etchanese declared it a holy war against the Dutch and started engaging in guerrilla warfare.
Okay.
So in September 1893, her new husband, Sukuk Umar, surrendered to the Dutch along with about 250 of his men, and he said he wanted to join the Dutch army and fight with them. So the Dutch army welcomes him and appointed him a commander, but it was actually just a trick. 2 years later, Umar set out to assault Etche, but instead he departed with his troops, the equipment, weapons, and ammunition the Dutch had given him, and brought them to help the Etchanese.
Okay. I was about to be like, how are you gonna insult her like this?
Right. So this moment is actually recorded in Dutch history as, quote, the treason of Tuku Umar. I mean, of course.
Well, yeah.
So he reunited with Dian, and the two, with their new supplies, continued to fight against the Dutch. Shortly after, though, the Dutch sent a specialty group of soldiers called the Marachese, and the Etchanese found these troops very difficult to fight.
Okay.
So the Dutch were also starting to adapt guerrilla warfare tactics against the Etchanese.
They were smart monkeys.
Yeah. A surprise attack was launched against Tuku Umar, and he was killed. And when she heard about his death, Kut Gambang, their daughter, began to cry. As you do.
I mean, sure.
Reportedly, Dian slapped her, hugged her, and said, as Etchanese women, we may not shed tears for those who have been martyred.
Oh my God.
Like, suck it up, kid. We're going back to the front lines.
Stone cold.
Oh my gosh.
We don't shed tears for our martyrs.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So after the death of her husband, Dian took control of the Etchanese army and continued to resist the Dutch until 1901. Unfortunately, the number of her troops kept decreasing and they suffered from a lack of supplies. And personally, Dian was developing arthritis and nearsightedness as she got older.
Mm.
One of her men eventually betrayed her and revealed her location to
of
the Dutch.
Of course it was a man.
Despite her fighting back, they captured her, but Kut Gambang escaped and continued the resistance until the war was officially declared over in 1904.
Wow.
So yeah, now we have to research
like a 25
her.
25-year war.
Yeah, and this little girl now is the head of the whole army.
I want an episode about her.
All of it. So Dian was not killed. She was actually sent to a hospital where she could heal from her arthritis. And then she was exiled to West Java because the Dutch didn't want to risk keeping her in Indonesia because she would raise the resistance again. They were pretty smart.
Yeah.
In Java, she was not treated as a prisoner and was allowed to teach religion, and she became greatly respected by the people there. She died on November 6, 1908, at the age of 60. In 1964, the president of Indonesia proclaimed Kutni Ekdan a national hero. She's been featured on stamps and banknotes of Indonesia.
How cool.
There's an airport named after her. And in 1989, a film was made about her life and won Best International Film at the Cannes Film Festival.
Oh, my word.
I know.
How cool is that?
She's awesome.
I just have this picture in my head of her riding into battle, baby slung across her back, wielding swords.
I know. We should watch this movie. Yes. They'll probably have that in there.
Oh, my God.
I'm so ready.
Movie night. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Sophie was born May 9th. 1921, so a little bit after a couple years later in Vogtenburg am Koche, which is a German word.
Clearly.
Did my best. To parents Magdalena and Robert Scholl, and she's actually the fourth of six children.
Wow.
Now, side note, her father was actually a liberal politician who had been the mayor of Vogtenburg am Koche, where she was born. And he was an outspoken critic of the Nazis at the time, which, of course, was not a good place to be.
Ew.
Or not a good position to have.
Right.
Because it meant that he got arrested at one point as well. And I'll get to that a little bit later.
Okay.
So as a child, she and her siblings joined the various Nazi groups for children that were popular in the 1930s. Because, of course, the Nazis were not always seen as the monsters that they turned out to be.
Right.
They got to power through very normal means. People voted for them. People supported them. So she joined the Bund Deutscher Mädel, the League of German Girls.
Mm-hmm.
And her brother Hans joined the Hitler Youth.
Okay.
However, they quickly became disillusioned with the Nazi party, especially when their own father was so vocally critical of it. Sophie, she began to develop her interest in philosophy and theology. And when she was able to graduate secondary school, which was high school, in 1940, she almost flunked out because she had lost interest in all of the Nazi indoctrination that was happening at the school.
Oh, wow.
The subject of her thesis essay was called "The Hand That Moved the Cradle Moved the World." So immediately upon graduation, she became a kindergarten teacher at the Frubel Institute in Ulm. And she liked children and also actually hoped that the job would prevent her from joining what was known as the Reichsarbeitsdienst, or the National Labor Service.
Okay.
Did not say that correctly. The National Labor Service was actually an agency created to help mitigate the unemployment of the German economy. And it was also a strategy to militarize the workforce and indoctrinate it to Nazi ideology. So starting in 1935, it was actually mandatory that all men aged 18 to 25 actually joined the labor service. And during the time of the war itself, it became mandatory for women to join it as well. So try as she might,
right.
Sophie was not able to get out of this 6 months that she was required to be a part of it. And in 1941, she began her work as an auxiliary war service nursery teacher. So she's still teaching. She's still doing the work that she'd done beforehand. After her 6 months, she enrolled in the University of Munich to study biology and philosophy. Her brother Hans was actually already in attendance there studying medicine. And he's the one who introduced her to his friends, a group that would later go on to become part of the active resistance against the Nazis.
Ooh.
They were originally all drawn to each other, though, through a love of art, music, literature, philosophy. They spent a lot of time together doing what college students do. They went to concerts together, sports games. They attended plays and lectures. They really had a very normal life, you know, despite everything else that was happening in the country at the time. 1942 rolls around. During that summer, Sophie had to go do war service in a metallurgical plant in Ulm.
Oh.
But this is when her father actually gets arrested because he had made a critical remark to an employee about Hitler.
Ooh.
And apparently he's quoted as saying, quote, "The war is already lost. This Hitler is God's scourge on mankind. And if the war doesn't end soon, the Russians will be sitting in Berlin," which actually ended up happening.
Wow.
So he was right in the end.
Snaps to that.
But he was arrested and he had all of his positions stripped from him for saying this. At the same time, Fritz Hartnagel, who is Sophie's boyfriend, is actually deployed to the Eastern Front, to Stalingrad. Not only is she actively resisting, but her boyfriend is actually a Nazi soldier, is part of the German war effort.
Is this a movie?
It is a movie.
Okay, good. Yeah. There's so much drama.
There's a German movie called Sophie Scholl, The Final Days, and it's all in German. It's all on YouTube. And it's actually, the whole movie is her interrogation by the police.
All right, which we'll get to.
Okay. Exactly. And actually, we're going to get to it right now. During this time, 1942, her father's arrested. Her boyfriend is off fighting on the front. And she joins a group called the White Rose.
Ooh.
She finds it first through a pamphlet that she finds. And the White Rose was a nonviolent intellectual resistance group, was led by students and professors at the University of Munich, and gained attention and members by publishing and distributing anonymous leaflets and through graffiti campaigns.
Mm.
The first ever leaflet said that the Nazi system had imprisoned the German people and was now destroying them. And at the bottom of it, it said, quote, please make as many copies of this leaflet as you can and distribute them.
Wow.
This is allegedly the first time that internal dissent against the Nazi regime had surfaced in Germany in such a blatant fashion.
Yeah.
Now, Sophie found out after she finds the pamphlet that her brother had actually helped author it.
Oh, whoa.
And so she said, dude, I want to do it. And she joined the White Rose as well. She shared with other members the letters from Hartnagel, her boyfriend, who was off fighting, who wrote to her about the German war crimes being committed on the Eastern Front. He had seen Soviet prisoners of war shot in what he called mass graves. And it was also there that he learned of the mass killing of Jews as well.
Oh, man.
Before he departed, Sophie had given Fritz two volumes of Cardinal John Henry Newman's sermons.
Mm.
And
I'm just getting chills, like listening to this whole thing.
In their letters to each other, they discussed what was called the theology of conscience. And these letters between them would actually later be used as evidence against her in her trial.
Oh.
So Sophie is a core member of the White Rose. It's her and five other students as well as their professors. And they're circulating three more White Rose pamphlets all in this one summer in 1942. Mm. And the five other members were Hans Scholl, her brother, Will Graf, Christoph Probst, and Alexander Schmorell. Two other women were also members as well, although not considered core members, core founding members. Their name were Katharina Liepelt and Marguerite Mrosek. And initially, her brother had actually tried to keep her out of it, but she proved too useful because as a woman, she was randomly stopped by the SS, much less frequently by the guides. So she could hold and take documents or these pamphlets, and there was much less opportunity for her to be caught with them. The great thing about this is that the pamphlets didn't just stay in Munich. They began popping up in the University of Hamburg, as well as in other places in Germany, and they started making their way over to Austria as well. Now, February of 1943, so a couple months later, Hans and Sophie are actually arrested as they're distributing their sixth leaflet at the University of Munich. And if you watch this movie, this is actually where the movie picks up.
Mm.
They're brought in. They're interrogated. Sophie gets interrogated for 17 hours. And the next time she's seen in public, she actually has a broken leg at the same time as well.
Oh, man.
February 22nd, so 13 days later, they're put on, quote, trial in the People's Court, where they were
not... I just rolled my eyes. You can't see it, but I did.
They were not able to provide any defense for themselves, but it didn't stop Sophie from shouting out, quote, somebody, after all, had to make a start. What we wrote and said is also believed by many others. They just don't dare express themselves as we did. She also apparently said to the judge, quote, you know the war is lost. Why don't you have the courage to face it?
Wow. Oh. Whew.
Now, their parents actually tried to enter the courtroom during their trial, and they were stopped. And they were told by the guards that they should have raised them better. But from inside, I know.
Oh.
They raised them perfectly fine. Thank you very much. From inside the courtroom, their father Robert could be heard shouting, one day there will be another kind of justice. One day they will go down in history.
Oh.
Didn't that just give you that? Yes, I've
been getting chills this whole story.
Needless to say, the judge found them, her brother Hans, and Christoph Probst, who they had also found and arrested and put on trial as well, guilty of treason and condemned them to death. And they were beheaded only hours later.
Oh.
By guillotine.
My God.
Right? Her parents were allowed to see her in the last, before they were executed. And apparently Sophie did not cry at all while they were together. And her parents offered her candy. And when she took it, she's reported to have said, "Gladly, after all, I haven't had any lunch." Isn't that just like,
she's been so strong. I've got to watch this movie.
So she didn't cry when her parents were there, but one of her cellmates, her name was Elsa Gebel, was there. And she's where we get Sophie's last words from. And this is her last words that we know of. "How can we expect righteousness to prevail when there is hardly anyone willing to give himself individually to a righteous cause? Such a fine, sunny day, and I have to go. But how many have to die in the battlefield in these days? How many young, promising lives? What does my death matter if by our acts, thousands of people are awakened and stirred to action? Among the student body, there will certainly be a revolt."
Wow.
Does that not make you think of what's happening literally right now?
Yeah.
Apparently, the prison guards were so impressed by her, her brother, and Christoph's bravery and resolve and how calm they were that they actually let them see each other as well before the execution. Before Hans was beheaded, he cried, "Long live freedom." And after the three of them were killed, the Gestapo continued to search for the other members of the White Rose, and three more of their members, including their philosophy professor, were also executed as well. Now, after their execution, a copy of that sixth pamphlet that they were arrested whilst distributing was smuggled out of Germany and to the UK by a German jurist named Helmuth James Graf von Moltke, who gave it to the Allied forces, who changed the title to the Manifesto of the Students of Munich and dropped millions of copies of it.
Wow.
Playwright Lillian Garrett Grogg said in 1993, quote, "It is possibly the most spectacular moment of resistance that I can think of in the 20th century. The fact that five little kids in the mouth of the world, where it really counted, had the tremendous courage to do what they did is spectacular to me. I know that the world is better for them having been there, but I do not know why." And another historian, Judd Newburn, said, "You cannot really measure the effect of this kind of resistance and whether or not X number of bridges were blown up or a regime fell. The White Rose really has a more symbolic value, but that's a very important value."
Wow.
Now, some honors. The Geschweister Scholl Institute for Political Science at the Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich is named in honor of Sophie and her brother Hans. Geschweister means sibling, so it's sibling Scholl. And it's home to the university's political science and communications departments.
Wow.
There are many schools, streets, and squares in Germany named Scholl in their honor. In February 2003, a bust of Sophie was placed by the Bavarian government in the Walhalla Temple in her honor. In the early 2000s, the magazine Brigitte, a German magazine for women, voted Scholl the greatest woman of the 20th century. In 2003, a television broadcaster invited the country to participate in a nationwide competition to choose the top 10 most important Germans of all time. Mm-hmm. And Sophie and her brother Hans came in fourth place above Bach, Goethe, Gutenberg, Bismarck, Willy Brandt, and Albert Einstein.
Oh my God. Who was number one?
That's a good question. On May 9th, 2014, Google created a Google Doodle for her as well on what would have been her 93rd birthday.
Wow.
In February 2005, a movie called Sophie Scholl, Die letzten Tage, or Sophie Scholl, The Final Days, was released, featuring the actress Julia Jentsch. The movie won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. And for her portrayal of Scholl, Jentsch won Best Actress at the European Film Award, German Film Awards, and the Silver Bear for Best Actress at the Berlin Film Festival.
Yeah, I have to watch this movie.
Yeah, it's actually pretty, it's pretty amazing. So yeah, that's Sophie Scholl.
Wow.
Student leader of a resistance.
That's, I'm just speechless, I have to say.
Hey friends, If you are loving these episodes, you should do us a favor and go look down at that phone or tablet or computer you're listening to this podcast on and give us a rating or a review. Those ratings help other people find this podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. Thanks.
Hey, listeners, if you're enjoying this podcast and you've already given us a rating and a review because you're awesome, you know what else you can do? You can check us out on patreon.com/UrsulaMajor and become a patron. For just a couple dollars a month, you can get access to tons of exclusive goodies. Keep your eye out. We're adding some new and awesome things very soon. Thanks.
Going off the first half of the episode, which is the resistance is female.
Love it.
Why don't we talk a little bit about what's happening right now in the moment, these student-led protests?
Absolutely. I mean, it ties in so well to Sophie Scholl and her brother and all the students in Berlin. Max, you were able to go down to the March for Our Lives yesterday. I was so bummed I had to work. It was stupid. What happened at the march? What did you see?
The march was amazing. If you go to our Instagram, you can see pictures. We've just posted a couple of them. And we handed out stickers, the Bitches Get Stuff Done stickers that we've got. And it was amazing. Actually, the response to the stickers alone was kind of amazing. But to see the students out there and so many young people gave me literally so much hope for the future, like serious rays of light poking through the dark clouds kind of hope. It gives me really, it's exciting. And you know what I've been thinking about is that when the history of this time, like when future civilizations look back on this moment in this civilization, they're going to see that even our students, even our children had a movement, stood up and said, this is not right, or they saw something. And I think it really is unique in history, what we're seeing right now, that a student protest on this kind of scale is having this kind of an effect.
Amazing to me. I totally agree. I mean, I haven't come across something that is so impactful and, like you said, is primarily led by youth, by young people, which is just stunning to me. Like, I always wanted to make a difference. I'm trying to make a difference in the world, but there are young people out there who are showing me up and I love it.
And the fact that these kids are doing it while like receiving death threats and working in this world where they've got a target on their back and it's never been more dangerous. I mean, literally.
Yeah.
Right? I think one of the most powerful speeches I've seen come out of the marches yesterday was the students at Newtown High School who were kids at that elementary school when the shooting happened. And now they're high schoolers and they unfurled a banner and said, Newtown stands with Parkland and this needs to stop.
And it does. I mean, that's the thing. We do need to find a way to move forward and move past the protests and get something actually done. And what gives me so much hope is the courage of these young people and how they're encouraging other people to stand with them. And because they're young, and when you're young, even me today, like, you have such an optimistic view of the world despite everything. It's like they're not gonna stop.
Yeah, it's
they're
like
they're not gonna stop.
It reminds me of a quote that Carol Burnett said when she founded the Carol Burnett Show, and she said, you know, I was so naive, I didn't know it couldn't be done, and so it could.
Yeah.
And it's like that's exactly what's happening. Like, these kids are not phased by the world yet. They don't have the wool over their eyes to say, you know, this can't be done. And so they're standing up and they're protesting. And it gives me hope for the future, because it not only is them enacting change and using their voices, but it means that going forward, they're going to be more engaged. Going forward, they're going to be more involved, if for no other reason that right now we're experiencing like this great education. People are realizing rights that they didn't even know that they had. And if they knew they had a right, they're realizing and learning about how to exercise their rights. They're learning about how to actually implement the change that they want to see in the world. And that for me is I think the most powerful, and I think what's going to be the most lasting change for us coming out of not just this, the Never Again and the Parkland movement, but also through the Women's March
and through
the Me Too movement and all these other things as well.
Yeah, it really does feel like we've hit the wall and now we're just tearing it down.
Absolutely. The time has come.
Mm-hmm.
Hashtag time's up. Legal Defense Fund.
For real.
Really, really. If you want to go check out pictures of us at the march, we had a whole team there handing out stickers and going on a march together. You can go to our Instagram. There's a lot of pictures there, and there's going to be some on our Facebook as well.
Mm-hmm. And if you want to get involved and know more about what we're talking about, you can go to marchforourlives.com. They have a bunch of resources, actions, voter registration toolkits to help people get registered to vote, which I also think is awesome. Like, yes. I feel like I had to convince people in my generation to go out and register to vote.
Yes, and why their vote mattered.
And I don't feel like I have to have that conversation with people that are younger than me, which is beautiful.
Absolutely.
Because I voted like the very first time that I could vote. It was for one office. My grandparents took me to the polls. I could vote between two people. That was literally all that was on the ballot. It was like this name or this name. That's it. Which, thank goodness, because I'm also like weirdly always nervous about doing things wrong. So I was like, at least I can't mess up voting. Like, there's only two names to choose from and I can't pick both.
Right.
But I kind of felt that I met a lot of people in college that just were like, yeah, I don't vote. I'm not registered to vote. Like, it doesn't matter. Look what happens when you don't vote.
Especially in this year, we've seen multiple elections. I mean, the Pennsylvania 18th came down to 600 something votes.
It matters.
The presidential election came down to 43,000 votes split between three different states. There was a race for the Virginia House of Delegates, which literally came down to one vote. They disqualified the vote, so there was a tie, and then they chose the name out of a bowl. That's how they decided who sat in the House seat.
Wow.
We've seen that for a long time, because I voted as soon as I possibly could. Yeah. I was going into the booth with my parents before I could vote.
Oh, I always did kids voting. Yeah. Kids voting was the best.
Yeah, and so it's like it's fun and it's empowering, and what I'd say is, not only get your friends registered, but also figure out a system to be like, okay, I'm going to drive you to the polls, or you're going to drive this person to the polls, and we're going to figure out how people are going to get to the polls.
Or I did that
2 years ago.
2 years ago, I drove a friend to the polls early in the morning before she had to go to work.
There you go.
Because I was like, you're voting today. You're voting. Yeah. Don't tell me you don't have a car. That's not an excuse. I'm picking you up. What time? 7:30? That works for you. That works for me.
Good. Yeah, and that's exactly the kind of attitude you have to have about it. It's like, yes, you're going to vote.
So if you want any more information on the march or voting or have any other questions, just go to marchforourlives.com. If you have questions for us and want to stay in touch, you can find us on facebook.com/thebitcheryofhistory or just search The Bitchery of History. We're also on Instagram at The Bitchery of History and Twitter at Bitchery Podcast.
You can also find us, as always, on patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. You can also download that app.
Mm-hmm.
As always, a huge shout out to our team. We could not do this without Jess,
Sydney,
Kim,
and Jeanette.
And as always, bitches get stuff done.